Okay. I see. Sorry. Wait. Do you? No, it's not different than the other ones, is it? Oh, yeah. In 9th edition. So 6th edition, they reprinted it in
Oh,
10.
okay.
I was just wondering if I could see, is there like a more full version of this art? But okay, anyway.
It really looks like a dong.
It's phallic.
It's very phallic.
Welcome to episode number 62 of the Memory Jar. As always, we are here to remember the cards, the decks, the people, and the stories that make Magic the game we love. I'm David Prestwood, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Christian Wright. Christian, how you doing?
All things considered, I honestly can't complain. I'm itching to play some real-life Magic again, though. It's been over a year, and I would debase myself to hear some jerk say, "How's it still in a pack on a Friday night?" What about you?
Oh man, my favorite thing is definitely to crack open a new pack and say, "How is it still in the pack?" and let
How's it
everyone at the
still
table
in
groan at me.
the pack?
Played a little webcam Magic recently. I played with you and some of your friends. We did a little Commander, that was great. But yeah, I want to crack some packs in a store. Couple months, maybe we'll all be vaccinated and we can get there. So we'll see. But while we are waiting for that to happen, let's do what we do best and go back to the past. Let's talk about an old Magic set that focuses on time, impermanence, and of course, sweet old borders.
Is this our time spiraling mastered episode? I wasn't prepared.
No. Maybe we'll do one of those. I don't know. But we're going to talk about Mirage. So Mirage was the first kind of traditional Magic set. It had the things we normally associate with Magic sets. It was designed in part with Limited in mind. It was a cornerstone fall set that set up an upcoming block. That was a thing that happened for many years until the last couple. And then it was also Magic within a real-world inspired setting. They also did a real honest-to-goodness mass pre-release for the set.
Oh, this is
So
exciting.
there's a lot to talk about. Before we get to that, though, as always, let's crack open the memory jar. All right, the random card button on Scryfall has given us Goblin Goon. Goblin Goon, 3 and a red for a 6/6 Goblin Mutant. This is a rare from Legions. Goblin Goon can't attack unless you control more creatures than defending player, and it can't block unless you control more creatures than attacking player. So basically, it doesn't do anything unless you have the most creatures. Conveniently, it's a goblin.
Yeah, it's designed to be your big beater in a go wide goblin deck. This was printed in Legions. All the cards in Legions are creatures, so you could have played Goblin Goon. I don't know. I actually played this then as a, God, how old was I? I was in middle school probably, so 13. Even as a 13-year-old, I recognized this card sucked. This card was so bad. Yeah, one of the things I distinctly remember opening this in a pack of Legions, looking at it, and I was surrounded by people much older than me. And I looked around and I just remember being like, I can't play this card with these adults. They're not going to play it, and I'm not going to play it. And it did wheel. So, Bully Goblin Goon. Awful Magic card.
You know, it has a couple unique things going for it, primarily that it is the biggest goblin. At 6/6, there's no larger goblin in Magic, which is not particularly surprising. It's also a goblin mutant, surprisingly not a unique creature type. There have been a bunch of goblin mutants through Magic history. Mutant is not only limited to the Simic Combine, but where we saw this most recently was in Jumpstart. And I think its presence there was mainly to disappoint people, because if you got the goblins pack in Jumpstart, you were definitely hoping to open one of the ones that had Muxus as the rare, and sometimes you just got Goblin Goon.
So yeah, we played some electronic Jumpstart recently, and I had a Goblin pack. I was very excited. Turns out, Goblin Goon. So yeah, funny thing about Goblin Goon too is that almost all the other red rares in Legions were fantastic to open. You know, like you had Click Slither, which you know wanted to sack all these goblins you were creating to get big. You had Killmouth Dragon, which is a fantastic dragon finisher. It had Amplify 3. It dealt damage, equal number plus one counters on it. Heck, even like Lava Born Muse was just better because it was, you know, a four mana 3/3 that did apply pressure if your opponent was trying to outrace you. Goblin Goon was probably only just better than Skirk Alarmist. And Skirk Alarmist had haste. It was a 1/2 for 1 and a red, and all it did was turn face down creatures face up, and then you sacrifice them. So it wasn't even that great. But that was like the only other red rare where you're just desperate to not open in Legions.
Yeah, never got to play Legions. You know, that was before my time. But the all creature set is interesting. Maybe we'll have to simulate a draft sometime and figure out what that looks like. The fact that it was a really morph heavy set obviously made a lot of sense, because without things like instants and sorceries, you need all of these additional effects on creatures. So fill the board and then play that way. But yeah, I see somebody trying to put together a morph cube based around a lot of what happened in Legions.
Oh, yeah. You also got cons to go fall back onto in Time Spiral Block. Yeah. Sounds great.
Well, that's a long way from Goblin Goon, but a 4-mana 6/6 Goblin with some assorted drawbacks is just not the card that you want to see coming out of your pack. But we're going to go back before Legions, and we're going to talk about a near 25-year-old Magic expansion now, Mirage. So as I said before, Mirage was kind of revolutionary for its time. It introduced a lot of these really foundational Magic tropes, or things that we probably take for granted today about sets. You know, the block structure we've moved on from, but this was the beginning of that. It was designed in part with Limited in mind, specifically when we say that we're talking about Sealed. And so when they did pre-releases, they had these little tournament packs, so that made a lot of sense. And then this was really one of the first things where it was the kind of Magic but with X type of world building. So Kaldheim is the most recent set as we're recording this, and so that's kind of like Magic, but in a Norse world with Norse mythology. And that has been a template for a bunch of different kinds of sets. So let's talk a little bit about that world building. Christian, what did Wizards do here that was unique?
So Mirage was the Magic set in Africa block. According to our research, the setting of the world was created after it was designed. So the set was designed originally in 1992. It was codenamed the Menagerie. It was designed with alpha cards in mind, and it was iterated from 1992 to 1995, and then started in full development from 1995 to 1996. Once it was developed and led by legendary Magic R&D and now probably corporate bigwig Bill Rose, they handed it to the art director, Sue Ann Harkey, and she looked at this and said, you know what, let's put this in an African setting, right? Like this, for whatever reason, all this stuff screams Africa. So they created a setting where there was three empires inspired by the ancient and medieval West African empires, chiefly among them the Ghanaian Empire and the Malian Empires. The three nations were the Zalfir, the Femeref, and the Squata. And we'll include some resources in the show notes so you can read up more on these ancient and medieval West African empires. They're fascinating. And because of this, a lot of the art was informed by this. Now, because Magic didn't have very hard and fast style guides, not all the art conformed, but there was definitely a lot of direct inspirations. And it's this very evocative setting of the plains of Africa, the deserts, the jungles, and the coastal areas of Africa that really resonates and shines.
Yeah, the art in this set really, really holds up well. I think some of the early sets have some real stinkers, to be honest. And this set is pretty consistently hot throughout. I'm really impressed. I look back and you have some of the super stylized stuff. Richard Kane Ferguson has a bunch of cards in the set, for example, and some more straightforward things and some art that is almost kind of photorealistic, which Magic has gotten away from. But it really all complements each other well and is kind of what you would expect from a modern Magic set.
It comes off as kind of very mystical. Like you have something like fire breathing, which kind of looks a little out of place, but it's next to things like Spirit of the Night, which was done by Cliff Nielsen. That's right, that's Therese Nielsen's ex-husband. But it's more abstract and it's very 90s. There's like one of the eyes is a shell and it looks very otherworldly, but it just fits. It just seems like that would be the spiritual dark realm where the Spirit of the Night comes from. It just fits so well, and you get all these examples throughout the whole block. So listeners, it's worth Googling the story. We're not going to go in depth. Teferi was formally introduced in this block as far as planeswalkers that now have a modern impact. And a lot of things and events like on Teferi's protection happened in Mirage or prior to Mirage. Honestly, reading a story summary kind of makes it look like they took a lot of the cards and they just kind of threw a story on them. Kind of reverse how they do it these days, but it's still a good story. And you see some of the legends they've reprinted recently. I think in Corset 21, they had Mangara, they had Karavek, they had Jarel, which are all highlights within Mirage and Mirage Block. And yeah, it's worth checking out. But let's talk about something a little more near and dear to your heart, Dave. Mirage was the first set explicitly designed for Limited.
Yeah, the dawn of kind of actual pre-modern limited started in Mirage. There's an article from 2003 that we'll link to in the show notes on Mirage's development, and in that article, Mike Elliott detailed that they focused on actually playing sealed deck starting with Mirage and subsequent sets. So we're not really drafting yet, but they're looking at sealed. And so the team assigned internal ratings to cards, they play-tested them, and they kind of adjusted cards over and over to try to balance them between the colors. It didn't really end up balanced on release, but that is, of course, a problem that still continues to this day. Unless you get cards in the hands of the masses, it's hard to really tell what works and what doesn't, but you can imagine it was a little more pronounced at the time. On that note, Mirage was also the first mass pre-release set in Magic history. So Homelands had the first actual pre-release event, but it was only in one location. Mirage, on the other hand, they premiered at a Pro Tour, which is wild, and they pre-released it across multiple cities. So Matthew Vino, and I'll link to his article as well, talked about showing up at a Pro Tour and not knowing all the cards you're about to play with.
Yes.
Which is fascinating. So, as you look at the set, if you go through to Scryfall and just search up Mirage, you might think, this doesn't really look like it's designed for Limited. It's not designed for Sealed. And certainly a few reasons. One, color hosers were all the rage back then, and they're just very miserable and limited. They create this weird dance where your opponent probably doesn't play them game one, although sometimes maybe they did, because these color hosers were so backbreaking that if you just hit the lottery, you could shut down your opponent's entire deck. Let's say they don't. So then they side one in for game two. If you see that, do you consider switching out of that color for game three?
No. Because at the time, okay. I don't think that was a thing. There's another reason why, but well, that'll be a reason we'll dictate in a little bit.
I mean, if your opponent does consider that, if you have played a backbreaker in game two, and you think your opponent might switch colors, do you side out the backbreaking card knowing that they're going to try to play around it in whatever way they can? Whether or not they switch colors. Probably not. I don't know. They're bad for Limited.
Yes.
Beyond that, so many of the cards in this set cared about colors. Like, not every deck wants a Trumpet Blast, for example, but there's a card here called Nocturnal Raid that was an uncommon. It was 2BB for an instant, and it said all black creatures get +2/+0 until end of turn. So if not every deck wants a Trumpet Blast, how many want a Trumpet Blast that gets to a third of the creatures in your deck? That's right, I said a third, not a half. Because back in 1996, you had to play sealed with the lands that came in your tournament pack. And that meant you would get 5 or 6 lands of each color. And so the question was not, are you playing 2 colors or 3? It was, you're definitely playing 3. Are you playing 4 or are you playing 5? Because your lands would dictate that. You just hope that you have, maybe you get 6 lands in a color with most of your good cards. Yeah, particularly challenging. So even though they were designing and thinking about sealed, they were just not there yet.
Well, and they also had egregious things like Fireball at Common, so you know that's going to be a fun limited format. They had a lot of removal everywhere. Incinerate is in this. You have unconditional, you know, red removal. Dark Banishing is in this. There's other ways to destroy creatures in black that are really easy to get at. You had Drain Life. This ridiculous amount of removal will cost 2 or 3 colors, and you're like, I hope you open it, because otherwise you're screwed.
I assume when you say Fireball at Common, you mean Kervex Torch. Is that right?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay. Just want to clarify that it's not actual Fireball.
No,
because it was like, well, there's Kervex Torch, but if I missed actual Fireball too, they really went wild.
No. The funny thing is, Kervex Torch is their attempt at a better Fireball, which is even funnier.
So. Well, although, I guess the difference is you can't split it between multiple creatures like you could for Fireball.
No, it's hard to counterspell, which is very relevant, considering this set, they have multiple blue counterspells that are common and uncommon. So. Mirage Limited was really, really cool. Mirage was the first set that had unified block structure, where the mechanics that you see in the first set are echoed and built upon thereafter in the next 2 small sets. It also was released in the fall. And so the idea of a large fall set to start the year, and then a winter small set, a spring small set, and then a core set in the summer, which is now standard. Back in the day, it was every 2 years, so hope you got one, otherwise you had 6 months of no magic. That became the standard that lasted almost 20 years until Battle for Zendikar, which switched to a 2-set block, and then now we don't really have blocks anymore. The other notable thing with Mirage is the fact that the schedule is set in stone. So the previous large set was Ice Age. That was released in June. They couldn't even line up the season with the setting. Prior to Mirage, Magic sets were released very hodgepodge, but they put it in stone that, yep, you're going to get a fall set, you're going to get a winter set, you're going to get a spring set.
If you just look at the big sets, Tempest, that was October. Following that, Urza's Saga, October. Following that, Mercadian Masks, October. So it really did kind of churn this way for a long time. So let's talk about those set mechanics. Mirage introduced two really interesting mechanics to the game that we saw, and then they've sprinkled in very rarely. Flanking and phasing. So flanking is relatively straightforward. If a non-flanking creature blocks a creature with flanking, the blocking creature gets -1/-1. That's all there is. We didn't see this for many years, and then in Commander 2016, Siddhar Kondo of Jamura, who is a character from the Kingdom of Jamura, which is relevant to Mirage, had flanking. And that was basically the only one in the last decade or so. So flanking is interesting because it does outright kill X1s, which, as you noted when we were talking about this, is a brutal way to learn about how flanking works.
Yes. It's funny because they try to fix flanking with Bushido, and that is not any better. They haven't attempted to try to do something like flanking since Kamigawa block, and I think that's not coming back for a long time.
Bushido and flanking and Rampage and all of these things that care about creatures blocking and how many they're blocked by, and those mechanics have just traditionally been very unsuccessful. But the more interesting one, phasing, is much, much weirder. And very similarly, we've gotten a couple cards that have phased things out or care about phasing in the last few years. It's kind of like they're just bringing it back. They eroded Oubliette from Arabian Nights to now phase something out until Oubliette leaves, which is not really phasing, but we'll get on that. So essentially, here's what happens when a permanent phases. It just doesn't exist every other turn. It doesn't leave the battlefield. If there are auras or equipment attached to the permanent, it just stays on them. But they just are considered not there for a turn, and then they phase back in. They never leave the battlefield, they're just not there. So when something phases in, it doesn't trigger an enter the battlefield effect. When it phases out, it doesn't trigger a leaves play trigger. The best analogy I heard for this was conversation about Teferi's Protection, which is commonly played in Commander, but the main thing it does is it phases out all of your permanents and gives you protection from everything. And so the way it was explained to me is, imagine putting a pillowcase over your playmat while all your things are phased out. They're still there. You just can't see them. Nothing can happen to them. And then when they phase back in, you just pick up the pillowcase and everything is as it was. So again, they don't really leave play. So if a token phases out, it's not exiled. It's not like bouncing a token. It just stays there. Is that a reasonable explanation of phasing? I feel like I could have done banding more quickly than this, Christian.
They've made it easier to explain. Before probably last year, I couldn't give you a straight, coherent answer to how phasing works. The weird thing is when cards actually have phasing on them, it means they do it every turn. It's not a one-shot thing. Like, Wizards been kind of smart. They've slowly been reintroducing phasing, but as one-shot things. Like, it's just phased out. There are a lot of cards in Mirage Block and Mirage specifically that just have phasing, and you have to remember, oh, so they just don't exist every other turn.
So those are the mechanics. Unique, not something we see very often. But I do want to talk about some things we see often. Mirage introduced some, what I'll call, card archetypes. So for example, charms.
Yeah, so Mirage, notable for introducing charms to the world of Magic the Gathering. You might know some more famous ones, such as Boros Charm or Esper Charm, but they really got their start in Mirage. So they've kind of had the same sort of templates in them. There's at least three options to choose from that are all individually not worth the mana. What's great about them is they add flexibility. So you having the option to do one of three spell effects on a spell, everyone's loved it since they released. These were tournament playable, played in sideboards, some played in main decks. The original set of charms were all one CMC instance. There was a cycle of five, one in each color. One of the more played ones was Ebony Charm. The three options were target opponent loses one life and you gain one life, or you can exile up to three target cards from a single graveyard, or target creature gains fear until end of turn. What's great about this is, again, I wouldn't pay one mana for any of these just as a single spell, but the fact that I have that flexibility, I could kill someone if they're at one life, get rid of three cards, or you can have your creature push through for the turn, all fantastic to have on one card.
So as you mentioned, we've seen these for the shards and for the wedges. We've seen them for the various guilds in Ravnica. And charms kind of begat commands, mm-hmm. which begat sublime epiphany. You know, a charm with many options where you can just choose them all if you want. And so a lot of interesting design space. And that started here in Mirage. One of the other archetypes that started here are so-called pacifism effects with the card Pacifism. So Pacifism is one and a white for an enchantment aura, and it says enchanted creature can't attack or block. These are really standard now. Every set, you kind of expect to see some kind of pacifism variant. Sometimes they're good enough to see standard play. Sometimes they're not. But you know when they're two mana, those are the ones that might make it into the format.
Yeah, it's really funny how this is a signature white effect now, and they're all first pickable magic cards in Limited. They nailed it on the head, and it took two or three sets to make that a standard. I think Mercadian Mass, if I remember correctly, had a rest, which was a more expensive pacifism that stopped activated abilities. But ever since then, it's just become kind of the standard. You're going to get a pacifism, you're going to enjoy it.
So there's this class of cards that we call polymorph effects. And the original was from Mirage. Polymorph was three and a blue for a sorcery. And it says, destroy target creature, it can't be regenerated. Its controller reveals cards from the top of their library until they reveal a creature card. That player puts the card onto the battlefield, then shuffles all other cards revealed this way into their library. So generally you're using this on your own creatures, not your opponent's creatures, to cheat out something very large. And you're not doing it in blue for the most part anymore. You're doing it now in red, which kind of makes sense flavorfully because red is the color of chaos. And what is more chaotic than flipping cards off the top of your deck and seeing what comes up?
I'm glad they changed it to red. Are you glad too?
I think it would make more sense in blue if it was restricted to one of your creatures or one of your permanents, because blue just doesn't generally destroy opponent's creatures. It can exile them and then give them something else in the classic Pongify or Raven form from Kaldheim mode. So definitely doesn't feel blue. Also, just worth looking at this original Robert Bliss art of something that was a rabbit, apparently, and is now... No, not a rabbit. Donkey. I think it's a donkey. Turning into something horrible and screaming the flavor text, ah, opposable digits.
Also, worth mentioning about this card particularly, so Robert Bliss has a famous history for sneaking in male genitalia into his art. If you look at any polymorphing printing past Mirage, you don't see the bottom half of this donkey rabbit thing, but that's because in the original Mirage one you did, and it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good at all.
So speaking of the color pie, what is the deal with the out-of-whack color pie in the set, man?
Dude, it's 1996, man. We were focused on the Olympics and Michael Jordan. I don't know.
Yeah, that was kind of a joke question. The color pie was not really a concept at this point in any meaningful way. So, for example, you have Jabari's Influence, which is a white control magic effect. You have counter spells in black in Withering Boon and white in Illumination. This is not mana tithe. This is not an intentional, you know, an intentional break. We're not making fun of the color pie here.
I love that there's white mana fixing, which is Celestial Dawn. I'm just going to read this one. So it's one white for an enchantment. Lands you control are planes. Non-land permanents you control are white. The same is true for spells you control and non-land cards you own that aren't on the battlefield. You may spend white mana as though it was mana of any color. You may spend other mana only as though it were colorless mana. So yeah, white mana fixing.
Yeah, kind of a roundabout way to get there, but they certainly got there. There's some black land destruction in Choking Sands, which was something, I mean, Sinkhole was a card in Alpha, obviously, but something that we've certainly moved away from. That's a red now, and occasionally green, if you're not talking about land specifically, but usually a non-creature permanent. I mentioned a black Trumpet Blast earlier. That's not a thing. I know you're a big fan of Barreling Attack.
Yeah, I mean, it's a red card that gives a creature trample, and it also pumps it if it gets blocked, but it's an instant, so you can set it up if it gets, like, chump blocked. It gets +1/+1. What is this card?
Yeah, that's definitely a green effect now. You have unconditional creature removal in red in Cindercloud. I'm not going to read the whole card, but it does say destroy target creature on it, which is not something that red gets.
No downsides.
You've got a green dragon. Not something you see very often outside of dragon-focused sets. Now, this one at least doesn't natively have flying, but you can pay one and a green to give it flying and have it lose trample. So Canopy Dragon kind of jumps, I guess. And then one of the weirdest cards in the set, which we tweeted about this week ahead of recording the show, Malignant Growth is a weird Simic card draw hate effect. It gives everyone except you a Howling Mine and then makes them take damage for drawing cards from it. Yeah, that's not in any way a Simic effect. That's a black, red, maybe blue card. That goes in your Nekusar Commander deck, except it is green for some reason.
Let's transport our minds to 1996. We're going to eat Big Macs, and we're going to play some Sega Genesis. We look at this card, and we think, oh, it's blue because you draw cards, right? Well, you don't draw cards. Your opponent draws cards. Okay, but it's green because green hates drawing cards? So there's where the damage comes in, I guess?
Does green hate drawing cards?
I don't know, man. This is 1996.
I think it's green because they named the card Growth, and then they decided if it says Growth, it's just green. That must be the answer.
I don't know. One of the things we did point out, and people did point out on this when we tweeted this at a friend of the show, Shivan Bhatt, you can't proliferate this card very well because the way proliferate works, it adds another counter of every type. So if you have a growth counter on it and you've paid cumulative upkeep on it, it adds an age counter and it adds a growth counter. So it's not great. It's just neutral. No upside, all downside.
Yeah, they changed proliferate a few years ago, so you pick the permanent, and then it just adds one of each counter that's on that permanent. It's very weird here that they decided to put growth counters on it in addition to the age counters from cumulative upkeep, considering it will always have the same number of counters on each one. All of that's a long way of saying there was a bunch of weird stuff in this set, but we get to the good stuff. There are a lot of notable cards, including some very famous ones that Commander and Cube players are extremely familiar with.
Very familiar. So we're going to start off with a mini cycle. It's an incomplete cycle if you include Visions, which is just a great shaft for red. This is the Tutor cycle of Enlightened Tutor, Mystical Tutor, and Worldly Tutor. So each of these are one CMC in their respective colors. So Enlightened is white, Mystical is blue, and Worldly is green. They're all instants, and each of them searches for a card, and then you shuffle your library and then put that card that you tutored for on top. So Enlightened Tutor searches for artifacts or enchantments. Mystical Tutor searches for instants or sorceries. But back in the day, it was instants, interrupts, mana sources, or sorcery cards, because those were all four different cards in 1996. And Worldly Tutor only searches for creatures, because we can't let green search for lands. That's too good. Duh. But yeah, these are, I mean, as you said, the Commander staples. Like, these have been reprinted in 6th edition.
Yeah, this was kind of a new twist on the Tutor. These are all obviously references to Demonic Tutor, a card from Alpha that was one in a black, and you just search your library for a card, put it in your hand, and shuffle. We had previously had Merchant Scroll, which was the first card that allowed you to search, but then you had to reveal what you searched for, because you had to prove that it was a particular type. And so these all did that. And then the best part of the cycle, obviously, from Visions was Vampiric Tutor, which was a single black for an instant, and you search your library for a card, shuffle your library, then put that card on top, and you lose 2 life. So another one mana tutor. And then we just never got the red part of the cycle, I guess unless you count Unglued, where we got Goblin Tutor, and I'm just going to read that because I'm considering this the card that completes the cycle. It's red for an instant. You roll a 6-sided die. On a 1, it has no effect. Otherwise, you search your library for the card indicated by the table on the card. Reveal that card to all players, put it in your hand, and then shuffle your library. So if you roll a 2, you get another Goblin Tutor from your library. A 3, an enchantment. A 4, an artifact. A 5, a creature. A 6, an instant or sorcery. Just what is happening? Anyway.
Unglued, man. It's not... So this is weird. Gamble, I guess, could technically finish this cycle, but I'd never consider it. Because A, you could discard it. You have to randomly discard a card. None of these cards do that. B, it goes to your hand. It doesn't go to the top of your library. C, no one played Gamble back in the day. So that's why. Like, it was sort of played, but it was not reliably consistent. People played Demonic Consultation first before they played Gamble. So, yeah,
Gamble's also a sorcery, so I think Gamble's out.
Yeah, Gamble's out. So, yeah, it's always been an incomplete cycle. I think if they ever do this would be a great card for Modern Horizons 2, is the red version of the cycle. I don't know what you would put in there. Maybe you do it for Planeswalkers, because it's a new card type that wasn't captured in the other four. Just never happened. Wizards just kind of slipped the wheel. They're like, oh, what? Oh, no, we gave all the other card types the other cards. What do we do? I don't know. Just don't print.
I think that's why they used really sweet Quentin Hoover art for Goblin Tutor, is they really wanted to make it up to everybody.
Yes.
Well, how about one of the most broken combo pieces of all time?
Tell me more.
Why don't we talk about Flash?
Let's talk about Flash.
Card that is banned in Commander, banned in Legacy, and restricted in Vintage. Flash is one in a blue for an instant, and you may put a creature card from your hand onto the battlefield. If you do, you sacrifice it unless you pay its mana cost reduced by up to two. So a way to cheat a creature into play, get its enter the battlefield and dies triggers if you want, or a way to just cast a creature and basically pay its full price, but then it gets Flash.
So, like, I think I know why this is broken, but this doesn't on its face seem bad.
Well, that's because Protean Hulk was not a card when Flash was printed.
Oh, you're right.
You want to just run through that combo?
Oh, I'll run through this combo. This is the worst setup I've ever done in my life. I hope you like Splinter Twin, because this is Splinter Twin, except it happens on turn two or turn one. So here's the combo with Flash. You have to have Flash and Protean Hulk in your hand. You cast Flash. You choose to bring Protean Hulk into play. Because you can't play the full 7 mana cost for Protean Hulk, it dies. What happens when Protean Hulk dies, you ask? Well, Protean Hulk, when it dies, it allows you to search your library for creatures with combined converted mana cost of 7 and put them into the battlefield. Oh, okay, so that's cool. You get some big creatures, or one big creature. What do we get here? Well, you're going to get two specific creatures first. You're going to get Carrion Feeder, which is 1 black for a zombie. It's a 1-1. When you sacrifice a creature, you put a +1/+1 counter on Carrion Feeder and it can't block. We don't care about the not blocking part. We're not going to attack Carrion Feeder. The second card we get is Karmic Guide. Karmic Guide is 3 white-white for an angel. It's a 2-2, Resident Imprint Urza's Legacy. Has Echo, Protection for Black. What's more important with Karmic Guide is it when it enters the battlefield, it returns a creature card from your graveyard to the battlefield. So, you notice something here. Wait, I can return Protean Hulk. You're absolutely right, you're going to return Protean Hulk. You return Protean Hulk. You want to sacrifice it immediately. This is, by the way, all on the stack. All of this is happening on the stack. You don't ever get off the stack until you attack. All of this is happening at instant speed. Excellent combo. So you sacrifice Protean Hulk to Carrion Feeder. You search up for Kiki-Jiki. Now here's where the fun part happens. So when Kiki-Jiki gets in the battlefield, you tap Kiki-Jiki to make a copy of Karmic Guide. Well, you target Karmic Guide. With that ability on the stack, you sacrifice Kiki-Jiki to Carrion Feeder. And then when the Kiki-Jiki Karmic Guide ability resolves, you have a copy of Karmic Guide that allows you to return Kiki-Jiki. Rinse and repeat, infinite Karmic Guides on turn two with an infinitely large Carrion Feeder should, I don't know, settled records didn't exist in 2007, so who the hell knows how you're going to lose the game at that point. But you have infinite Karmic Guides, you attack for the win on turn one or turn two. And that, my friends, is why Flash is banned in every single format known to mankind.
Yep, that will do it. That's the combo. So the way this card was originally printed was busted. And I think people knew that. And so what I learned from you talking about this is Wizards used to like to do power level errata, where they would just functionally errata cards to reduce their power level. And they did this with Flash when it was reprinted in 6th edition.
Yes, so it was, when you look at the 6th edition printing, it's busted. But a few years after, Wizards was like, whoa, we can't let this be busted. What are we doing here? So they changed it in 2003 to say, choose a creature card in your hand. You may pay its mana cost reduced by up to 2. If you do, put that card into play. If you don't, put that card in your graveyard. So they changed Flash from, you know, originally just putting the creature in play to saying, if you can cast it, you can. Otherwise, this is the worst discard effect known to mankind.
Yeah, it's just throw a creature in the yard. So I'm glad that they don't do this kind of power level errata the same way, where they're just like, the text on the card is no longer what the card does. I would rather them just ban things than do that. And of course, they repealed that errata at some point, and that's why Flash is now banned in these various formats. But I guess other than Companions, which was a power level errata, we haven't really seen that in the last, you know, 10, 15 years.
No, we haven't. And, I mean, there's been arguments to reintroduce it for, you know, Oko. Like, hey, man, sure, just pretend that +1's a -1 at second ability. We good to go, right?
Yeah.
But, no, it's power
things level. Things that a digital card game can do and a paper card game has a little more, a more trouble with.
Yeah. So, Flash. There's going to be a little mini theme that runs through some of these cards, listeners. They're cards that were not great when they were introduced. Flash, you could literally probably pick up by the handfuls if you went to your local card shop and paid like a nickel for them. Turned into very powerful cards thanks to Wizards of the Coast deciding to change their rules or print new cards.
All right, well, I've got a great one for you.
Yeah.
One of my favorites, Tombstone Stairwell. So cool. So Tombstone Stairwell is 2BB for a world enchantment. If you don't know, a world enchantment means there can only be one world enchantment in play at any time. So if you have this in play and someone else plays a different card with the type world enchantment, you sacrifice your world enchantment. Not something that comes up very often. Anyway, this one has cumulative upkeep 1B. So that means you put an age counter on it during your upkeep and you have to pay 1B for each age counter on it, or again, you sacrifice it. Here's what it does. At the beginning of each upkeep, if Tombstone Stairwell is on the battlefield, each player creates a 2/2 black zombie creature token with haste named Tombspawn for each creature card in their graveyard. Note, this is each player doing it each upkeep. And then at the beginning of each end step, or when Tombstone Stairwell leaves the battlefield, you destroy all tokens created with Tombstone Stairwell, and they can't be regenerated. So it basically just throws a bunch of creatures into play every turn, and maybe if you have more creatures in your graveyard, you can attack with them. Maybe you just have a Blood Artist, and so when you sacrifice all these creatures at the end of the turn, you drain your opponent for a whole stupid amount of life. This card is really, really, really sweet.
Very sweet. It has been, you know, fantastic art. This was on a previous episode, isn't that right?
We talked about this when talking with Ryan Overturf about the Spooky Cube. Tombstone Stairwell is in Ryan's Spooky Cube. It is notorious for, I believe, everyone who drafted it for the first year or so of the cube went 1-3 if they put in their deck. I actually broke that. I went 2-2 with a spooky Tombstone Stairwell deck. So it's just an awesome card. I highly recommend if you have one, you play it. Unfortunately, it's on the reserve list, so it's up in the like $18 range now. But it's just a cool, totally unique effect.
It is. And I just also wish they bought Enchant Worlds back, because I imagine flavor-wise, you're on a battlefield, your Planeswalkers cast, and all of a sudden pop from the ground zombies. How cool is that? Better than Field of the Dead. Field of the Dead, not flavorful. Tombstone Stairwell, 500% more flavorful.
Let me raise another iconic one that I know is one that's one of your favorites.
Yeah.
And that's Hammer of Begarden.
Yeah, Hammer of Begarden, an absolute classic burn spell. It's 1RR for a sorcery. Hammer of Begarden deals 3 damage to any target. 2RR, return Hammer of Begarden to your hand. You can use this ability only during your upkeep. And the original warning is great because it also specifies it has to be in your graveyard, which is a nice little cherry on top. But yeah, it's repeatable burn. How great is this card?
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. They've tried a bunch of cards like this since then. The one that I think of as the most clear homage to Hammer of Begarden recently was Repeating Barrage from Ixalan, which is very similar. It's 1RR for sorcery, and it deals 3 to any target. And it had Raid for 3RR, so you have the same cost. If you have attacked with a creature, then you can return it from your graveyard to your hand. Maybe kind of a fixed version of this, since you didn't have to wait for your upkeep to do it. You just still had to attack. But the idea that if you have an absurd amount of mana, or a locked up board and nothing but time, you can just keep doming your opponent for 3.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. This was came up recently. An old Magic pro tweeted that instead of building an old school deck, he built Ollie Raid's counter burn deck, and his only win conditions were Thawing Glaciers and Hammer Begarden, and it's absolutely appropriate. It's just all counter spells, and eventually I will kill you by hitting you for 3 in the head over and over and over and over.
I love the homage to this in Kaldheim. The backside of Torolf, God of Fury.
Yes.
Is Torolf's hammer. And it just feels very much like this. It's 1R for an equipment. And it costs 1R to equip. So you're already up to 2-2. And then the equipped creature gets 1R, tap it, and unattach the hammer. It deals 3 damage to any target. And then you return the hammer to its owner's hand. So it's actually a more efficient. It requires a creature, but it's 6 mana. So you're saving 2 whole mana to get it done.
Yeah, I love the homage, though. Hammers just got to keep coming back and forth and back and forth and punching people in the head.
That's what hammers do, apparently, in this game.
So let's talk about another red card, but it's like it takes a classic Magic card and adds a little twist to it. Final Fortune.
Yeah. So Final Fortune, red for an instant. Take an extra turn after this one. At the beginning of that turn's end step, you lose the game. So it's Time Walk.
Yep.
It's a red Time Walk with a pretty significant drawback. Like a lot of Mirage cards, this was bad for a long time, just not something that was really playable, until Wizards printed cards that negated its drawback. Cards like Stifle to answer the end of the game trigger, or Sundial of the Infinite, one of our personal favorite cards. You let the lose the game trigger go on the stack, and then you just end the turn, and you don't lose.
You don't lose. There's actually recently Commander Legend, it was in Grixis, that just ended the turn.
So if this effect looks familiar, we recently saw it in Guilds of Ravnica in Chance for Glory, which was one red white for an instant, and give your creatures indestructible, and it had the same effect. That card made a little more sense that it was an instant, because you can give your creatures indestructible, and maybe you want to do that in the middle of combat. I always found it really weird that Final Fortune was an instant. The functional reprints from Portal and Portal Three Kingdoms, Last Chance and Warrior's Oath, which were the same cards, were sorceries. And I guess in a multiplayer game, you could cast it on someone else's turn, so you take the next turn and try to, like, win before somebody has their big turn, but then you lose at the end of it anyway, so it's, like, very risky.
Yeah. No, I mean, that makes more sense. Yeah, I mean, in a pinch, you doing that, or, like, Glorious End or something, like, lets you try to do something before you're going to lose to the guy who just cast Avenger of Zendikar, right? So, got to try something.
Do people play these drawback extra turn cards in Commander? Like, do you have these in any decks?
No, I mean, I owned a Final Fortune back in the day, but no, I would...
Okay.
I would probably play one in at least one of my decks if I could get it. But right now, Final Fortune is a bucket of money, so that's not happening anytime soon.
No, well, EDH Rec has it in 2,373 decks. The Obeka Brute Chronologist you mentioned is certainly one of them. Good way to end the turn. Looks like some of the commanders that do a ton of damage or deal with extra combats are another place to play this card, where turning two combats into four combats seems like a way maybe you could win. But yeah, kind of an interesting archetype on its own.
I was going to say, if you just win on your extra turn, it doesn't matter if there's a drawback. So keeping on red cards right now, let's talk about Absolute Hunk. Like, we're talking about a prime Himbo here.
I already know what you're talking about.
We're talking about Dwarven Miner. So Dwarven Miner is one or red for a dwarf. Just a dwarf. Doesn't have a job. Makes sense as a Himbo. It's a 1/2, and it has two and a red tap, destroy target on basic land.
Yeah,
it's a Himbo. Himbo, baby. Illustrated by Jock in all caps.
Yeah, you just have to look at the picture. He's just, like, leaning up against the wall like, hey, what's up? I heard somebody needed a land destroyed. Just totally, totally ridiculous.
I have a thick pick that can deal with that situation.
Oh, my God. Okay, moving on. let's make it a little more wholesome with the most wholesome card in all of Mirage. You know I'm talking about Brushwag. So Brushwag, one green for a 3/2 Brushwag. And whenever it blocks or becomes blocked, it gets -2/+2 till end of turn. So it turns into a 1/4. This infamously is a card with only one of its type. But that was ruined forever. And thankfully, we needed more Brushwags.
Yeah.
By Almighty Brushwag in Ikoria. The 1/1 trample, you could, you know, pay some amount of mana to get +3/+3. I guess it was also ruined if you count Interplanar Brushwag from the Mystery Booster playtest cards. The, like, 6/4 that is on the Interplanar battlefield. And just, like, it attacks when each player attacks with, I think, a creature power 4 or greater. That card was wild. Anyway, Brushwag!
Brushwag!
Brushwag.
No, so, here's the thing. I have a question about Brushwag. I love Brushwag. It's not a question against the credentials of Brushwag. But I've always thought the Brushwag was just the brush, but every art since then included the cat. And I'm very confused by this.
Oh, you thought that the brush itself was the creature, not the thing in the brush.
No, I think, well, it's the brush and the thing. That's how it's been, like, if you look at the new Brushwag, that's how it's illustrated. But I always thought it was just the brush.
No. It's definitely both. It's like the creature that has brush all over it.
Okay.
Basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, worse either way.
One of... But... It does. One of my favorite gifts from my local game store was they had an Italian copy of Brushwag, the Burlo Busto, that they gave me. And you know that one's in the binder.
Yeah, Brushwag.
The Swag Wag.
Just the Swag. Oh, what a lovely card. Let's talk about a card. It's innocuous, but I'm surprised it wasn't broken back in the day. This is Early Harvest.
Yeah.
So yeah, Early Harvest is one green-green for an instant, and target player untaps all basic lands they control.
Works really well if you're making extra mana, so mana doublers or anything else, obviously. But if you have, you know, 10 lands, you spend 3 mana on this, that gets you 17 mana for the rest of your turn. Seems like a pretty reasonable commander card in, like, a mono-green deck, maybe?
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it just put... What also helps is Heartbeat of Spring was eventually printed. That's just green mana flare.
And those were in Standard together, right?
They were. Thanks, because okay. Harvest Spring was in 9th edition, and Chambers of Kamigawa was printed right before that. So, yeah, I mean, it's just... just turns out if we want a bunch of mana, you know who to call. It's called Early Harvest.
Is there a reason you can think of where you would untap all of your opponent's basic lands?
Mesmeric Orb.
Mesmeric Orb! They just, every time they untap a permanent, they just mill one for each one. Wow, sick. All right, we busted it.
The reason this is also a combo deck is because the way wishes worked back in the day were different. So you could wish for cards that were exiled. So you could loop wishes and do some combo shenanigans by casting Early Harvests and stuff. And long story short, that's also why it was broken. But they fixed that. And that's now, we can't have fun like that anymore. No more fun. Just... only sideboard or bust.
Okay, so Early Harvest not totally busted, but you know what was busted was Cadaverous Bloom.
Go on.
3 black green for an enchantment. You can exile a card from your hand to add either black black or green green to your mana pool. This is a combo piece.
Yeah, so here's the combo. The full combo didn't come out until Visions, so you had a whole other set you had to wait. You had this, so it allowed you to exile cards in your hand, add green green or black black. You played this with Squandered Resources, also a black-green card, which allowed you to sacrifice a land to add one mana of any type the sacrifice land could produce to your mana pool. You played then Prosperity, which was also released in Vigilance. This was a blue card that was blue and an X. Each player draws X cards. So the idea is you cast a Prosperity, you pitch all the cards you don't need to cast more Prosperities, and you eventually cast a large Drain Life to kill your opponent in one turn. Cadaver's Bloom is actually a very infamous Magic card, too, because this combo was played by some very alleged notorious scumbags in Magic history.
Well, they are not allegedly notorious. They are absolutely notorious. Yeah. I guess alleged scumbag might be acceptable, but I don't know if that's alleged either.
No, I guess the better word is alleged cheater. I'm not going to go too deep on this guy. He's just a notorious asshole. His name is Mike Long. He's one of the early villains of professional Magic. While he was playing in the Pro Tour where he won with this deck, I believe that's correct. It was either that Pro Tour or another major tournament leading up to it. Maybe it was U.S. Nationals. I can't remember the exact tournament. But they found a copy of Cadaver's Bloom in his lap. Now, you want this card in play. Cadaver's Bloom is so important to this combo. So there was a lot of, rightfully so, accusations that he had this hidden in his lap so that he could just palm it, put it in play, and, you know, no one's the wiser. He denied it, but, you know, he didn't necessarily have the most sterling reputation. He wasn't Chris Bakula, so no one ever gave him the benefit of the doubt. Everyone kind of just assumed Mike Long was cheating. The thing that Mike Long did that was hilarious is that he accused Mark Rosewater and R&D of purposely putting this combo into Mirage and Visions. Like, they brainstormed and said, we have this cool combo deck, and we're just going to break these pieces apart into different sets for 1 year. And Mark Rosewater categorically denied it. Knowing early Magic R&D, I suspect it wasn't on purpose, but I also, you know, they could have just been, it could have been a massive Nixon-esque cover-up where they did really have this combo deck, and it just benefited only Mike Long.
I think they do a lot of unintentional things now, so I'm pretty sure that they did a lot of unintentional things back in the mid-90s. That's an excellent history lesson. I've got another one. Speaking of bad Mirage cards that became amazing thanks to other cards being printed in the passage of time, we might as well talk about the spendiest card in the set, Lion's Eye Diamond. Total garbage when it was printed. I mean,
horrible.
I don't even know how much I could have picked these up for, but it was pennies, you know, on the dollar. Pennies on the dollar. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So Lion's Eye Diamond is an artifact that costs 0. And its ability is discard your hand and sacrifice it, add 3 mana of any one color, and activate this ability only anytime you could cast an instant. It's a $500 card right now, man.
500 smackaroonies. Like,
mm-hmm.
Oh my god. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's you can get 3 copies in a stimulus check, so maybe not the worst investment, because this was only about $200 as of a few years ago.
Well, so this is another one that was a combo piece.
Mm-hmm.
The wishes that came out of Judgment, especially Burning Wish, are what made this card good. Because you could cast the wish to get a card from your sideboard, but while that was on the stack, sacrifice this, discard whatever else was in your hand, get yourself a Yawgmoth's Will, so you could play cards from your graveyard for the rest of the turn, cast that, and then just go to town?
Yeah, I mean...
There you go.
Like, in Legacy, they sort of do this, it's the same thing, except they have, like, Infernal Tutor on the stack, so it just turns into Demonic Tutor. Turns out it's fine in Commander, where, you know, there's certain commanders that you can recast your stuff from the graveyard, and...
Yeah, just another card from Mirage restricted in Vintage. No big deal.
Last one, I think, is worth other cards that were terrible, and then Passage of Time, etc., is Phyrexian Dreadnought. So, Phyrexian Dreadnought is... One colorless, I'm not kidding, one colorless for a 12-12 Dreadnought. Wild. Has trample. Yep. When it enters the battlefield, sacrifice unless you sacrifice any number of creatures till power 12 or greater.
Yeah, so again, Stifle.
Yep.
Mentioned earlier for Final Fortune. Torpor Orb and Torpor Orb effects. So your creatures that enter the battlefield, those effects do not trigger. So you just get a 1-mana 12-12 trample if you've got that in play.
Yeah, and it's funny because the original way it got, I want to say, like, broken was because of Morph. So they finally formalized the Morph rules, which allowed Illusionary Mass to work with Phyrexian Dreadnought. Everything coming up Millhouse with that, right? It's just absolutely fantastic.
I mean, I could do a whole show on Illusionary Mask at some point. Maybe that's... I'll introduce everyone to that horrifying nightmare. But just a really super cool card. It's just visually so interesting to see the 12-12 with the 1 and try to figure out what is even happening here. What could this drawback possibly be? And it turns out, yeah, you know, it's a pretty significant drawback, but there are ways to work around it that didn't exist initially. Sadly, another card that's on the reserved list. This is a card I would love people to be able to play with, but almost up to $100 at this point. Sealed Boxes of Mirage going for like $5,000 right now.
That's more than a stimulus check, so.
Yeah, seems pretty crazy to me that we've gotten to a point where everything is that expensive. But we're in the reserved list boom yet again, and there's no way out in the immediate future. So that's all the cards. I did want to talk about a couple of things that we do when we do the new set facts. So Secret Reach, for example. So we always talk about this, you know, recent sets of featured creatures that for some reason nobody notices have Reach. And just attack their flyers into. So like Jasper Sentinel and Kaldheim. And the land that misses Zendikon a chance in Zendikar Rising. But they used to have Secret Reach cards too. Now this one's a little tougher because there are only 3 cards in the set that deal with Reach. And I think the winner here is not actually a Reach creature. It's Chaos Sphere. It's 2 and a red for a world enchantment. And it says creatures with flying can block only creatures with flying. Creatures without flying can block creatures with flying. Or now, the errata, creatures without flying have reach. Like, nobody's going to remember what this does, even if it's sitting in the middle of the table. Even if somebody played it and you had to sacrifice your Tombstone Stairwell. So you're just going to attack into their non-flying creatures, which now all have reach.
Yeah, this is just confusion par, you know, scaled up. Like, this is just miserable. Mm-hmm. I don't even think they printed this in... the Mirage flashbacks on Magic Online. I have to go check, but I would be surprised. Oh, no, they did. You can get it on Magic Online, but I...
Okay.
Not fun. Also, cool art, though. I will say that.
Yeah, it is wild art. I mean, it's kind of a Chaos Sphere, so good job, Steve Luke.
Good job. Tongue Twisters. We normally talk about what card will cause you to twist your tongue. But it's in the word. I don't know why I'm trying to explain it. For Mirage, we have some good candidates. We've picked out quite a few. The first one is... Auspicious Ancestor.
Yeah, Auspicious Ancestor might get my vote. It's hard to say a bunch of times fast. There's also Granger Guildmage. A couple of difficult G sounds in there.
Yep. Caravex Hex. Just a lot of cuz and huh and huh. And yeah, no.
Yeah, that one's mostly just hard to look at because there's like a KS that makes an X sound and then an actual X.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of a lot. Prismatic Lace with the S's and the Z sounds.
Yep. C Scryer. Yeah, I'm just afraid to try say that fast.
Mm-hmm. No. And then you noted on the list Pirage of Urborg, which just sounds like your mouth is full of oatmeal.
Because it is. So yeah, I'm going to say Auspicious Ancestor is up there. I think that's my vote too.
Yeah, hard agree for me. So Auspicious Ancestor, the tongue twister card of Mirage. So that's Mirage. That's a pretty long summary. This is going to be a really long episode, so I'll keep the rest of this short. Before we go, man, what do we have coming up? What do you want to talk about in some upcoming shows?
Oh, yeah. So I think we need to talk about Time Spiral Remastered. I think that'd be super fun.
Sure.
We need to interview some people. Who do we want to interview?
Oh, man. There are so many good candidates for interviews. I will put together a long list. But yeah, we need to get back to doing some interviews. I know we've talked to some folks who I think would be great and have been excited to do it. So we should talk about some casual ways to play, how to play within your little COVID bubble. I mean, it's almost late, but we've started doing some more play, different ways to play on Arena that I've been working on, making a little Arena peasant cube to draft from. So that could be fun.
I also think, too, because some of us, even on this podcast, are starting to get the vaccinations. So how can we play safely with other vaccinated people in person that also doesn't kill other people? Worth a discussion.
Oh, totally reasonable. Also, like, what do you listeners want to hear? You got to tell us.
Tell us.
We're on Twitter at MemoryJarMTG. Just tell us what you want to hear. You want to hear more stuff about old sets, new sets, weird cards, different types. We have a lot of different kinds of shows, and we're happy to keep doing them. On that note, let's kill it. Thank you for joining us today. As I mentioned, we're on Twitter at MemoryJarMTG. You can tweet at us. Also, our DMs are open. And we would love your feedback. Tell us what cards you want to remember and what you want to hear us talk about.
Again, special thanks to Chris Yates for the logo. We greatly appreciate it. You can find Chris on Twitter at @CMYCompany. That's company with a K. And until next time, may you stay phased in, may you stay hydrated, and most importantly, don't get outflanked by your opponents.